Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. All right, so should be a good show today because there's a lot of bad news to cover. That's kind of what the show's about, so I'm not going to have a problem with all that. We got Dar Jamail on the show. He's the author of a couple of books about Iraq. He was an unembedded reporter in the worst days of America's role in the continuing Iraq war. Well, not that our role has really ended, but you know what I mean. During the American occupation there. And, hell of a great reporter. Knows a lot about what's going on, and there's a lot going on in Iraq, and it ain't none of it good news at all, I don't think. So we're going to have Dar on about that. And then James Ridgway, you may remember he wrote for Mother Jones Magazine. I think he used to be at the Village Voice. He wrote for Mother Jones Magazine about Jesse Trenadue and about the Oklahoma City bombing. For those of you who aren't familiar, I'll try to make a long story real short here. The government tortured and murdered a man in custody in 1995 named Kenneth Trenadue because they mistakenly believed that he was a guy named Richard Guthrie, who was Timothy McVeigh's buddy and a very probable John Doe number two. And they were trying to torture it out of him that he was Guthrie, but he really wasn't. And he fought back, and they beat him to death in his prison cell. But his buddy... His brother is a lawyer, Jesse Trenadue. And so instead of rolling over and being a victim of the government, he intervened and made sure that they were not able to cremate the body. And he proved what had happened to his brother, and he sued the hell out of him. And he recognized quite, you know, pretty quickly on, actually Timothy McVeigh sent him a message from prison that said, "I know what happened to your brother. He was mistaken for this guy Guthrie." And he didn't really take it that seriously until J.D. Cash called and said, "I think I know what happened to your brother. I think he was mistaken for this guy Richard Guthrie." And at that point, Jesse Trenadue went, "Holy crap, what is going on here?" And that was what happened. It was a case of mistaken identity. And seriously, red hair, mullet, gigantic upper body build, dragon tattoo on the right arm, red Ford pickup truck. I mean, you talk about, I think it was a Ford, maybe Chevy. You talk about mistaken identity. Man, it was one of those things. Not that they had the right to torture Richard Guthrie to death either, but you could see why they thought that Kenneth Trenadue was Richard Guthrie. But anyway, they killed him. But so the result of that, why this one particular murder in federal custody back in 1995 is so important to you and me, is because Jesse's repeated lawsuits against the government for what they did to his brother and the cover-up of what they did to his brother has led to tons of new information about the Oklahoma City bombing and the white supremacists who were in on it and how they were all a bunch of flip states witnesses and undercover informants, or at least former informants, and so therefore a giant cover-up. So people who are familiar, you know, been listening to this show for a while, you're familiar with this story. But many people are not. It's really the kind of, it's been the province before 9/11 and the entire massive cottage industry of conspiracy theory that has grown up since then. There was a much smaller conspiracy theory sort of a movement before 9/11. And this story never really did have much traction beyond them, even though it's a real thing here, that McVeigh had help and that the government covered it up, absolutely. And but it never did get much traction, and mostly it did with groups like the John Birch Society on the right, who sort of, you know, unfairly took the blame for what McVeigh had done. I mean, he wasn't even a militia guy. He was a neo-Nazi, Timothy McVeigh. That was his thing, is he was a Hitler-loving Nazi. And, but they blamed all the militia guys who, you know, they might be kind of politically incorrect or whatever, but they're not Nazis, you know? Or at least back then there was a difference. I don't know, I guess. Yeah, I'm sure there still is a difference. Probably. Anyway. But so the, you know, Bill Clinton said, everybody, Rush Limbaugh and everybody to the right of him are all responsible for the bombing, right? So then groups on the right had a vested interest in exploring the other alternative explanations for what had happened there. And but anyway, it was a great thing when Mother Jones decided to publish James Ridgway here on this story, because it just goes to show that, no, it is not a right-wing patriot movement conspiracy theory. It's a real set of events that happened in space and time. McVeigh was not alone in Oklahoma City that day. They claim his number one right-hand man, and the only right-hand man he had in the whole thing, was two states away in Kansas at the time, which is plausible and correct, I believe. And they claim that there never was a John Doe 2. His one and only accomplice was two states away the day of the bombing. It's a ridiculous lie. It's not even a damn lie. It's a stupid lie. It's not even plausible for a moment in the face of even just a tenth of the evidence. And, in fact, there's now been a book written, which is really, this guy Gumbel came from England and sort of plagiarized in a way. I mean, the way it's written, it seems like he basically plagiarized J.D. Cash and Roger Charles's work and some others and dumbed it down a bit, which I don't really mind, actually, because this story's so important and it needs, you know, acceptable voices to cover it. So the guy's name is Andrew Gumbel, and Roger Charles has the co-author credit. He was originally J.D. Cash's co-author. J.D. was the original reporter on this story out of the McCurtain Gazette in Oklahoma. But he died of pneumonia back in, what, 2006 or 7, I guess. And so Roger Charles wrote this book with this guy Gumbel, and it's a little bit of a dumbed-down version, but you know what? It's all in there, man. But it's acceptable, you know, to the establishment and all that. And this guy Gumbel, you can go and watch. He sits down with, I know I'm off on a tangent here, but this story is so important to me. So that's what I'm talking about right now. God damn it. This guy Gumbel went and did an hour and a half long discussion or something like that with Peter Bergen, who I don't agree with him on everything. And he's kind of a liberal Democrat, acceptable type, but I don't care. But he's a real ass expert on Al-Qaeda terrorism, and I don't know, I guess he supposedly has some expertise on the radical right, although I take liberal expertise on the radical right less seriously than somebody like his expertise on Al-Qaeda, for example. But anyway, they're at the New America Foundation, and there they talk about, yeah, McVeigh had some help, he was a Nazi, and here are their names, Guthrie and Langan and Brescia and whatever, whatever, and on down the line. Here's who helped them do it, and here's the guy, the Arizona miner with the brown pickup truck, and blah, blah, blah. So, it ain't no crazy conspiracy theory. In fact, what was the thing a couple of weeks ago where somebody was bringing up Gore Vidal? Oh, I know what it was, right? It was that article. I never did get the guy on the show, but it was that article at Salon.com about Gore Vidal writing about McVeigh and how McVeigh had used that phrase from Brandeis, Justice Brandeis, that government is the great moral teacher, right, in the place of Jesus or whatever other belief system people used to have. Now it's just the state is where we learn what's right and wrong. And McVeigh invoked that to say, if you kill people, I get to kill you back, basically kind of, you know, criminal thing. But then the article was a very thoughtful, well-done article. I forget the guy's name. He never did agree to do the show, unfortunately, but it was at Salon.com, and he ends up getting into Gore Vidal there and Gore Vidal's communication with Timothy McVeigh, etc., and then he links to Gore Vidal's lengthy article for, I think it was Vanity Fair, that unfortunately was published September 2001, so it got hardly any notice at all, but it's a very lengthy piece that Vidal did on McVeigh, and I think he's way too soft on McVeigh, actually. Gore Vidal is in that. But anyway, he gets into a bit of the conspiracy stuff at the end, the real story stuff at the end. And I saw where Joan Walsh and Glenn Greenwald and other kind of centrist liberals were talking about this on Twitter. And I said, hey, look, this is not a right-wing conspiracy theory, because here's James Ridgway. And here is Peter Bergen and Andrew Gumbel. And so these guys are okay for you to, along with Gore Vidal, for you to go ahead and stop toeing the official line and understand that McVeigh really did have help and the Department of Justice covered it up, led by Eric Holder, by the way, at the time. Anyway, well, Jaina Davis is wrong, but I gotta go. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I'm no good at timing these breaks. I saw Mirko in the chat room mentioned about, I saw Jaina Davis out of the corner of my eye, and then, yes, he quite correctly says her disinformation about Arabs being responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing, along with Lori Milroy trying to conflate Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's intelligence services together for us all, for crying out loud. Bunch of nonsense, and that certainly did help divert attention from what was really going on there. But hey, they had an agenda against Saddam Hussein, you know, because that's what Ariel Sharon wanted, so it was really important there. And then, yes, the SPLC is admitted to have been involved in running informants at Oklahoma City. It was, as J.D. Cash explained, it was a loophole around new rules, guidelines, I guess, that Janet Reno had put down about investigating religious groups after Waco that, you know, made it a little bit more difficult for them. So then, you know, since Elohim City was a supposed religious group, they kind of outsourced it a little bit and said, hey, Morris Dees, why don't you help us, get information about what's going on at Elohim City, which he did. And you know what? I think I have somewhere on my Trinidu Files page, there is a PDF evidence of SPLC involvement with Runa Strassmeyer and what have you, although I guess I couldn't promise you that I could find the footnote for you right now here in real time or anything. Hey, yeah, whatever happened to that guy Jared who was updating the Trinidu files? He actually did a great job updating them, but then there were more. And I have a page somewhere of all the Trinidu files, of everything he's gotten from the FBI and all that. And when I accused Eric Holder there, the current attorney general, oh yeah, it's right there about how Eric Holder is now going to talk to Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, very powerful senator, and to explain to him the facts of life about the Trinidus and the Trinidonts, as in, Mr. Senator, you will not hold hearings into what happened to Kenneth Trinidu. Because that would lead to the Oklahoma bombing, and if the people know the truth about the Oklahoma bombing, then they'll all shrug and not do anything about it. And we can't have that, so. And there it all is. It was Eric, the deputy attorney general at the time, or deputy assistant imprisoner of innocence, or whatever the hell that his actual title was. He was in charge of convincing the Senate to not hold hearings into the murder of Kenneth Trinidu. And what's great about that, too, is Orrin Hatch was already on the record. Somebody at Fox News asked him about it, and he goes on and on for like 5 minutes about how bad he wants to get to the bottom of it. And then nothing. Can you imagine the Oklahoma City bombing and Congress never held a single hearing? Any committee in either house. Yeah, what a mystery about what was going on there, huh, guys? Anyway, James Ridgway is going to be on the show not to talk about the Oklahoma bombing. That was my intro to, hey, everybody, did you know I'm going to interview James Ridgway today? I'm going to interview James Ridgway about solitary confinement. And not for the Oklahoma bombers. See, they all got away scot-free. But for other people who did crimes of much less magnitude. Remember the day that they executed McVeigh, summer 2001? They admitted right before the execution, you know what? We kept 10 million documents from the defense. Here you go. So they delayed the execution for a couple of weeks or something like that. And they still withheld the most important documents about Elohim City anyway. But then when finally they wheeled him in to execute him, his head was shaved. And according to the mainstream media, isn't that weird? His head was shaved. It's almost like maybe he was a neo-Nazi or something. Oh, well, never mind. Let's not follow that angle. Hey, let's blame every single person on the American right for the Oklahoma bombing, but let's not focus on the actual individual human being Nazis who helped him do the damned attack. Okay, consensus? Great. Agreed. Says Chance. I don't know how they do this. Is it magic? How do they get every newspaper editor in America to go along with this? I seem to remember something about an undercover ATF informant inside the FBI's plot to blow this building up. What the hell happened to that? Oh, well, let's just pretend that we never did hear her, you know? What informant? Anyway, God dang it. Go read James Ridgway in Mother Jones. You don't want to hear from me. Go listen to him. That's some good journalism right there, man. That's why I told Joan Walsh of MSNBC and of Salon.com. I said, Joan, dear, here's James Ridgway. He's acceptable. He's okay, man. He is not a John Bircher. He is the exact opposite of a John Bircher. Well, in some ways, I mean, they're both kind of anti-establishment, I guess. Outside of power. But he's no right-winger. He writes for the goddamn Mother Jones. And Mother Jones is not even hard left, right? Mother Jones is the progressives. The little bit left of center left. Right? Just to the left of the liberals. The progressives. Mother Jones. David Corn and them, right? Totally MSNBC friendly. Totally Salon.com friendly. It's not like, oh, the socialist worker. Which actually, you know, is it the socialist worker that... Oh, there's so many damn different Trotskyite groups. I can't keep track. Some of those, you know, socialists and communists actually do some good journalism, despite their ridiculous biases. At least they're biased against the empire. I'll take it. I prefer an anti-imperialist commie to any, you know, so-called free market imperialist, which, of course, is a direct and ridiculous contradiction. You might as well admit you're red if you love the state that much. But anyway... These are acceptable liberals. Andrew Gumbel, Peter Bergen, these are acceptable liberals. And they have now... See, it's all about social psychology, right? Has nothing to do with what are the actual facts. Did McVeigh have any friends or not? Is a mathematical proof of a concept, dude. He either did or he didn't. John Doe 2 was either Richard Guthrie or it was somebody else or he didn't exist at all or what? These are not matters of opinion. But they are matters of acceptable opinion. And so if you told Joan Walsh that, hey, the John Birchers have done some pretty substantial work on the Oklahoma bombing case you might be interested in, her response, of course, would be, no, I would not be interested in that. Don't be ridiculous. You're an anti-Bill Clinton conspiracy theorist, blah, blah, blah. Now, I actually suspect that she never even did read the James Ridgway link I sent her. Because why would she? It still is an anti-Bill Clinton conspiracy theory, isn't it? Even if it's in the Mother Jones. The biggest terrorist attack on American history since the FBI's second wounded knee assault, you know? At that time, twice as many people killed as the government's assault at Waco, even. And Bill Clinton and his entire government covered it up. I'm not saying he was in on it in the first place, but... He sure as hell had to have known that they were not pursuing every lead. There's a great chapter in the Oklahoma book by Gumbel where they just talk about the fight inside the Justice Department where they decided they are just going to stick to McVeigh. So shut up, everybody else who wants to cast a further net of suspects. It's just a decision they made. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter of the not quite over Iraq war and author of Beyond the Green Zone. And I'm sorry, Dar, what's the other one? Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Scott. The other book's called The Will to Resist. It's about soldiers who refuse to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Good one, too. I'm sorry I forgot about that. It's been a few years now. Here we are living in the future.
That's right.
It's kind of long past, and yet don't tell the people of Iraq that any of this is over, because I guess maybe it slowed down a little bit there for a while. America really did help the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army win their civil war against the Sunni Arabs for Baghdad, basically to cleanse them from Baghdad, as they call it. And yet they never did really win state monopoly power over the Sunni provinces, predominantly Sunni provinces of Iraq. And they also never really integrated the Sunni power structure into the new government at all either. So in a way, it sort of seems like, maybe the Likudniks or Joe Biden, that's the same thing, got their plan. That maybe that's what they meant all along, was to really divide Iraq in three. I don't know. The Ayatollah Sistani kind of insisted, and they kind of didn't have a choice. Anyway, point is that the war's not over, because the Sunnis ain't satisfied, and the Shia don't have control over them, and yet they're not willing to just go their separate ways either, and so everybody's killing each other. And you can address any and all of that you want, including the plan in the first place and whatever you want now, but just give us the bad news.
Well, I think you gave a good, broad political context overview of why Iraq looks like it does, insofar as the political and religious chess pieces on the board in the wake of kind of broader plans, you know, where Sistani's idea of splitting Iraq up in a sense kind of generally dovetailed into the Israeli-U.S. Aims for basically dividing Iraq into three states, a northern Kurdish state, a central kind of disenfranchised Sunni stand, and then a southern Shia stand, obviously, that's kind of already just an extension of Iran at this point. But really, what that plan even is not going so well, because I'm sure when they had the agenda of taking northern Iraq for the Kurds, that probably included at least the better part of Nineveh province, where Mosul is. But oh, lo and behold, their plans are going a little awry. So they're consistent on that part. You know, Mosul, the second largest city in the entire country, now completely under control of ISIS fighters, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria fighters.
I didn't realize it was the second largest city in the whole country.
It is. It's bigger than Basra. So it is. It's the second biggest, one of the wealthiest and most important cities, right on the Tigris River, right up there, not too far from both the border of Turkey and Syria, and of course, right on the border of the Kurdish-controlled part of the northeastern part of Iraq. So that's a big, big deal, that the government of Baghdad has literally lost military and governmental control of the entire city. And it's important to note where U.S. policy, I mean, the situation in Iraq looks the way it does today because this is the legacy the U.S. left. This is the result of the Salvador option that Rumsfeld even slipped up and accidentally mentioned to the media back when it was getting rolling around 2005, 2006. This is the result of the death squads and the fomenting intersectarian violence that you mentioned earlier, of backing one side against the other, turning them against each other, arming and funding both. So that's why Iraq is the bloodbath that it is. But then now throw in the Syria component. So you've got the U.S., Qatar, Saudi, other countries backing the radical Islamic jihadist in Syria, who, of course, are deeply affiliated, if not in a lot of ways, basically the same as ISIS in Iraq. And now this is why Mosul fell, in short, where you've got ISIS in Syria working in tandem with ISIS in Iraq, which is basically in central and northwestern Iraq, largely along the border right with Syria. And so join those forces together and send them into Mosul and other parts of Iraq, and you start losing cities in Iraq. So what's amazing, if you look at what's going on in southeastern Syria and then northwestern Iraq. I mean, ISIS is getting a foothold. I mean, at this point, I would argue that not that they're going to be establishing borders and setting up a consul and getting their own currency anytime soon, but I would argue that right now, as far as the ISIS goal of developing some sort of Islamic state in the region, it looks like they're kind of getting a little closer to it than they have been in the past, given how solid they are in certain parts of Syria, and now, of course, controlling the second largest city in the entire country of Iraq.
Man. All right. Well, so a few things here. Now, I just saw, I better follow this guy on Twitter. I don't know. Bill Mann just tweeted out this thing that Iraqi MP Hassan al-Bayati has claimed that ISIS has captured helicopters and are flying them over Mosul right now, if true, unprecedented and huge. And boy, you got that right. As you're saying, and you know, Jonathan Landa is using the exact same language as you in describing the State Department terrorism report that came out, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or whatever. They're like, hey, I mean, they really are building a state here. The Islamic State of Iraq was a nice name. It might as well have been the name of a football team. It sure as hell wasn't the name of a state anywhere until, actually, now it's really starting to look like one. At least, as you're saying, it's not, you know, complete. But then again, as Landate was saying, some of these areas in Syria, they really have set up their own little IRS and their Department of Motor Vehicles and whatever the hell, man. They are taking over and building, social services beyond just being your local warlords, you know. And there are places where, you know, as we're talking about, Maliki can't go there and Assad can't go there. And so maybe it's sort of just lawless Wild West land, but seems like there's pockets of real kind of proto-statehood building up. The Islamo-fascist caliphate that George Bush always pretended was out there and was the excuse for this intervention in the first place, they're building it. A whole damn country of bin Ladenites between Iraq and Syria.
And to me, that's one of the most amazing parts of this, that they, George Bush and company, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, created this imaginary boogeyman of, you know, this big giant Islamic al-Qaeda, you know, who's going to start taking over countries and dominate the world and then gobble up the evil empire United States, which of course did not exist. There was no inkling of it in existence when the invasion against Iraq was launched. And then now, as a direct result of U.S. policy, both in Iraq and Syria, and the so-called war on terror, that they have created it. I mean, I remember when ISIS was the first inklings I heard of it years ago, and you know, basically all that they had was a really, really bad website, and with a couple of videos of guys with their heads covered up carrying around black flags during a little kind of mock photo shoot that they did on a back street in Ramadi several years ago. I mean, that's kind of all it was in Iraq. It was laughable. I mean, nobody, including myself, took it seriously. And now, oh, whoops, they just took over the second largest city in the entire country of Iraq and kicked the entire Iraqi army out. And if it's true, they're actually literally now in control of parts of the Iraqi Air Force and using them at their disposal. And it's really, really amazing. I mean, the governor of the city, Athil Nujafi, actually had to be rescued. They almost actually caught him while they were in the process of taking over the city. So it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes.
All right. Well, I got a hell of a lot more questions for you when we get back from this break. We're talking with Dar Jamail. He lived through the worst of the Iraq war, reporting as an unembedded reporter there. And we're talking about the Sunni-based insurgency, such as it is, and America on all sides of this one, too, of course. And more when we get back right after this.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter of the Iraq War, author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. And there's so much to cover here, Dar. Obviously, there's the whole hypocrisy of America backing Maliki, Iran, and the Shiites in Baghdad, and ever since 2003, that side of this thing. And then yet back the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, which, you know, once you zoom out just a bit, you realize these are the very same guys. Al-Nusra, they say, oh, Al-Nusra's different from ISIS, but only because they're the Syrian veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq rather than the Iraqi veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is ISIS. But they're still Zarqawi's guys. And this has been their war, and America's on their side. I saw Bill Mann, again, the former blogger. I don't know if anybody knows who this guy is. Former blogger. Now he's on Twitter, and he's joking. Oh, what a great way for Obama to figure out how to arm the Syrian insurgency that he's been arming this whole time is just call his puppet Maliki back in Iraq and let them seize all the weapons that we gave Maliki's faction in Mosul and take that back to Syria again. And that's how completely illogical this policy is, if there's supposed to be a logic to it, which I don't mean to presume that. But it's amazing when it comes down to it, since it was the Al-Qaeda guys that knocked down our towers, then that means that, and Iran really isn't our enemy at all, then that means that this is really the highest treason in the world. And this, what's happened in Mosul today only drives home exactly what treason it is. America's support, the Obama administration support for the rebels in Syria this whole time. These are the guys who killed our guys in the Iraq War.
That's exactly right. And Iraq is the classic perfect example of a failed state. And it's largely at the as the result of all the U.S. policy throughout the occupation, as well as ongoing U.S. policy of having sold arms and training worth over $20 billion to the Maliki regime. And then, of course, what the U.S. is, the cards that they're playing in Syria of funding and arming and backing the most radical of the radical Islamists there. And look at Iraq today. I mean, it's there's no design left in what's happening. I don't think that any of this was planned. I mean, certainly it was never in any of the U.S. government plans to lose the second largest city in the entire country to the most radical of the radical fighters out there today. But that's exactly what's going on. And Iraq itself is in just total absolute chaos. I mean, it is currently under basically a national wide siege, excepting perhaps the deepest part of the Kurdish controlled northeast and the deep south that's under largely Shia control. And yet look at what's going on in the rest. You've got car bombs in Sadr City, bombings and gun attacks in Bakuba, massive attacks in Kirkuk, of course, Mosul, we've discussed that, massive bloodshed and car bombs across Baghdad, large parts of Fallujah also under control of ISIS. I mean, this is obviously a coordinated siege on their part. Meanwhile, Iraq is in just complete political tatters to the point where the outgoing governor of Mosul, coupled with outgoing Prime Minister Maliki himself, are literally calling on saying, hey, look, we'll get guns to civilians. I mean, you know that the government's lost total control when the military is not getting the job done enough, that they're willing to basically just start funneling weapons into civilians and asking them to fight for their country. I mean, you know all is lost for sure when it hits that point. And then look at what's going on politically. You have Sadr's political bloc, his parliamentary bloc is blaming outgoing Minister Maliki for all of the militancy and that's going on across Iraq, as well as how strong the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has become. There's political infighting, total fracturing of what was left of the failed state. And look at it on the ground. I mean, really, Scott, like how, what, I guess the really the only thing left that could happen is to see ISIS take total control of Baghdad and kick the government out of the green zone.
Crap. Well, I mean, boy, they would have to kill a hell of a lot of people because, I mean, the surge of 07-08, if it did anything, it made Baghdad an 85% Shiite city. And I don't know, maybe there's been a little bit of rollback since then, but not that much. I mean, I think Obama would have to reinvade from west to east now to really give them the capital. But then again, you know, I don't know, man. What the hell do I know? Maybe they could. You know what? Let me ask you this. And this gets kind of complicated here, but I want to understand best I can. And, you know, a lot of this is just, you know, subjective categorization, maybe from a Texan's point of view rather than the real, you know, reality on the ground. But that's why you're here. So here's my thing of it. My conventional wisdom from the Iraq war was that the Sunni-based insurgency was the Sunni-based insurgency and that ultimately it was run by the imams and the tribal leaders of Sunni Iraq. And they were the ones who were the bosses, and the Al-Qaeda berserkers, the Zarqawiites, were basically, you know, an auxiliary, and they were tolerated as long as they were useful. And I think they found out, the Sunni leaders found out too late that these guys aren't useful. They're making matters worse by the way they butcher civilians and then justify further sectarian cleansing of Sunnis from Baghdad and that kind of thing. They figured out, you know, probably too late that it wasn't worth tolerating these guys. It was backfiring. But anyway, they kind of turned on them, and they'd been offering the American government for years, we'll turn on these guys if you'll just stop attacking us for a minute kind of thing. Petraeus finally took them up on it. They turned on the Al-Qaeda guys and pretty much whooped them. And they went silent, at least. Maybe they weren't dead, but they went silent for a long time until the Syria thing started back up again. But then ever since the Syria thing started back up, or started up, people like David Enders and Coburn and others have said that, yeah, you know, not so much about this small percentage of the Sunni-based insurgency. In Syria, it is ISIS and al-Nusra. It's their war. Any Free Syrian Army or any moderates or any trained-up people from sent in from Jordan or whatever are just nothing but a margin, you know, a rounding error or something. This is entirely ISIS's war in Syria, virtually entirely this whole time. But then... and I'm sorry I'm going on and on here, but I got to get these things out. You'll know what to do with it. About I think it was last December, the Al-Qaeda flag flew over Fallujah, but just for a minute. And the tribal leader said, take that damn flag down. And they did, because it seemed like, no, the Iraqi tribal, Sunni tribal leaders really are still the boss. And maybe that old Al-Qaeda is a small percentage thing still holds more sway is still a more accurate descriptor of the situation in Iraq. But I'm sure I'm probably oversimplifying all this anyway, but can you tell me what you make of all that, of who's really zooming who here, who's the boss? Are the ISIS guys, you know, useful servants of the tribal leaders now, or they really are a threat to their authority in Iraq, or what?
No, you're spot on, Scott. I mean, I think most of that, speaking of it generally, is accurate. And I think that there is a gray area and some confusion around who's really in control between tribal leaders and ISIS, because that's still obviously being worked out. I don't think, I mean, obviously in a place, you know, where like what happened with Mosul, at least for the moment, ISIS is in control of that. How long that will last, who knows? Fallujah is probably a good example in that it's really the micro or the macro of the rest of the country from the central part going north, where parts of the city are absolutely under control of tribal leaders. I think probably largely the better part of the city, but there are also parts where certainly ISIS has control. Is it total control? Is it changing day by day? It's probably not total control. It probably is changing day by day. And I think that's really what we're looking at across the better part of the central and western and northwestern part of Iraq, where it's an extremely dynamic, fluid situation. It's changing by the day. But clearly there are areas like Nineveh province, where Mosul is located, big swaths of Anbar province, which is the biggest province in the entire country, that are generally being controlled by ISIS. But certainly tribal leaders still hold great sway and have a whole lot of power. And the problem is ISIS, I think another important point that we need to discuss is that ISIS keeps getting stronger as we go into the future because of a point that you made at the outset of our discussion, where there is no Sunni political representation in Baghdad,
where
from the beginning, Maliki pushed them out, has been horse trading with the Kurds and other Shia groups behind the scenes, and the Sunni have basically been completely left out in the cold. And so that, you know, with no political representation in Baghdad, more and more younger folks are saying, seeing what's going on and saying, look, you tribal leaders, you're not doing us any good. Standing down and waiting for you guys to try to do political horse trading in Baghdad is not working, so we're going to ISIS.
I'm an idiot talking with my mic off. Hang tight, Dart. Don't go anywhere. I got one more question for you. We'll be right back, everybody, after this break. All right. So now here's the thing. I wonder also about, religious warfare as the motivation here. It seems like back during the Iraq War, when it was so much, it was Sunni versus Shia. But it seemed like they weren't really fighting over who was a heretic or any kind of crap like that. They were just basically America had given them a proportional representation type of a system. And so everybody just signed up and voted for the, you know, religious slate, basically. And so they were separated by identity politics, not by their interpretation of, you know, what the Quran said or who was the legitimate authority since Muhammad or that kind of thing. And so, but now, you know, Patrick Coburn talks about how these ISIS guys in Syria are so hell-bent on slaughtering Shiites that they just, you know, basically, like, they're distracted. At this point, it's almost helping keep the West safe that they are, these guys are so hell-bent on slaughtering innocent Shiite civilians in Syria. And that, you know, and this is, I guess, to be expected, and maybe if you go back and listen to interviews of you and me from years ago, we probably both predicted this kind of thing, that feelings get harder and harder after all this bloodshed, and people get further and further away from the possibility of forgiveness, the basis for their hatred start to change and morph, and now maybe it's not just that Sunni and Shia are from different, you know, belief systems, but maybe now they think that that's really something, that heresy, for example, really should be a priority for punishing, that kind of thing, as we're seeing people crucified and hunted down for their beliefs. I mean, you would think that ISIS would be targeting Assad and his forces, but no, they'll completely go off the beaten path in order to kill some Shiites for a while, that kind of thing. So I just wonder what you think of all that and whether you predict that it could possibly get better from here before it gets much worse or what?
No, I think that'll be a really good thing to talk about, because then it draws in, you know, it completely implicates U.S., Qatar, Saudi, and what they're doing in Saudi, because they're basically backing these lunatics. And let's definitely go there. And I've got about 8 more minutes, and I got another call.
I don't even have that long. Give me like 3 or 4. But yeah, I mean, that's a great point too, about our friends, the Saudis, were backing our enemies, the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, this whole time, as we're on the side of Iran in that proxy war. And that really, that political fight really has so much more to do, and also who controls Baghdad, has so much more to do with this than, you know, who's supposedly representing what Muhammad would want.
Yeah, and I think we should try to bring in, I know we're going to be real short on time, but just the total incoherence of Obama's foreign policy that I mean, literally, you know, backing different sides at different times. I think that's just an important political point for us to bring in, just the complete lack of any kind of coherence in their foreign policy in the region at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, and since Bush, too. I mean, Bush is the one who launched the redirection for Jandala and for Fatah al-Islam and for groups like, you know, proto al-Nusra in Syria back in 2008 when he realized his big stupid mistake and handed Baghdad over to Tehran.
Yeah.
Too late. Way too late. But, yeah, I mean, the whole thing, I mean, I don't know if there is a coherence to it other than just expediting the chaotic collapse, but I doubt even that. I don't see any grand design here other than, you know, just a bunch of people who are no better, no smarter than George Bush and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama running this thing, and they don't know what to do except keep killing people.
Yeah.
You know? They don't know which ones to kill, though.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. All right. Anyway, I'm sorry, man. But so wait, do you think I'm right though? Is that really a correct interpretation though, that sort of this kind of anti-Shiite hatred is becoming a more predominant theme among the Sunni resistance types, the Al-Qaeda types?
I think it's completely accurate and one of the most important points, because I mean, certainly, man, I mean, when I lived in Doha, I mean, that is the policy of the Qatari government, which is right in line with the Saudis. I mean, we're talking about the Wahhabis. Right. And so, yeah, they want all Shia dead. That's the deal. I mean, and what they're doing in Syria specifically is really the direct playing out of that policy. And the U.S. is 100% in bed with it.
Oh, man, what a disaster.
That's a really important point.
All right. Thanks so much, Dar. I'll let you go, but let's do this again soon. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.
Everybody, that's the great Dar Jamail, unembedded reporter from the Iraq War, author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And Liz Sly, Washington Post reporter, is tweeting out this picture of ISIS guys with American Humvees captured from Mosul today, already making their way back into Syria. The Islamic State of Iraq is an actual place now. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Well, I guess it won't be long before America invades and goes to war against Al-Qaeda there. I mean, the truth of this, oh, we got to back the rebels. Those people are going to have to shut up now. The rebels are Al-Qaeda, Bin Ladenite, Zawahiri-loving suicide bombers. And I think it's just a matter of time. I mean, God, I guess it might wait till Hillary or Jeb comes, but I think Obama's going to end up having to put troops in there to shore up Maliki and Assad's governments. I mean, are they really going to let there be an Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? ISIS is going to go from a group to a place, and they're going to allow that to really stand? And I'm not saying invade. I'm saying abolish the United States of America as a government. Pentagon first. Oh, Pentagon and CIA first. Can two things be first at the same time? Yeah. How about the whole thing first, all at once? U.S. national government vanish off the face of the planet. That is the first solution to our terrorism problem. But I'm just talking about the world we live in and what our government is going to do. And cue the right-wingers turning on a dime. They have to now, don't they? They can no longer. Enough of the cognitive dissonance. The bad guys from the last war are the good guys in this one. Which is it? And since they crucify their opponents in the town square and cut their heads off and set off suicide bombings in schools and declare their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri and the goals of Al-Qaeda, then that kind of means that I'm not saying they existed in Iraq before 2003. I'm saying George Bush created this entire mess. But if there's a good guy and a bad guy there, the good guy is the fascist secular dictator that just got reelected. He's an autocrat who was just reelected. And you know what? It was not the freest and fairest election, of course. And many Sunnis did not get to participate in it. Many people out in the countryside did not get to participate in it. But the vast majority of Syria's populations live in the towns. And they voted in huge numbers for Assad. It's not that they love a fascist dictatorship. It's that he and his government are standing literally. You know, like our government is always pretending to protect us. His government actually is the only thing standing between them and a good beheading. And they know it. Again, yes. And every one of these things, like amen, every sentence out of my mouth should have to end with, because of Bush and Obama, amen. Because of Bush and Obama, this is true. Because of Bush and Obama. Overthrow the secular dictators. You know, Lou Rockwell on this show 10 years ago said, and now these neocons want to overthrow Assad, the last Middle Eastern country where you can get a drink. Now that they've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, is Syria, and now they want to get rid of him and turn the whole place into Islamistan, and then I guess we'll have to have a big war against them. God dang, really? Because that's what John McCain wants? Or what is this? Because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants? I'm so tired of this. It's madness. It's absolute madness. Although, you know, that Bilmon joke on Twitter there made a lot of sense, right? In a way, what a great way to arm up the rebels in Syria. Let them sack American-funded and created bases, Iraqi army bases, on the other side of the former Sykes-Picot line. Hey, Maliki, pull your guys back and let Al-Qaeda take all the equipment. Right? Why not? I mean, I'm not saying I think that's what happened, but I'm saying that's how easy of a joke it is. And I guess whatever arms that they give them in Jordan and Turkey now are now deniable as spoils of them sacking Mosul. Oh, no. Come on, Scott. You oversimplify things. Obama wants to back, has been backing the moderate rebels. The moderate rebels? No such thing. Not in Syria. These guys are the Bin Ladenites. And yeah, they're mercs in a manner of speaking. They were sent by... Did I interrupt him when he was starting to talk about Bandar or something and we never got back to it? I apologize for that. Prince Bandar, Bandar Bush, they call him. He's the one sending Mujahideen to Syria. But who are the people who volunteer and go for this stuff? Where do they recruit these guys from? They recruit them from the most radical mosques. You know, those who can make you believe absurdities, can make you commit atrocities, that kind of thing. And so the Free Syrian Army has basically been an imagination of the Western powers. I mean, Hillary Clinton tried two or three different times to create these, new Syrian governments in exile. And every time, not just the military leaders of the FSA, but even the civilian leaders of the government they try to create in... Well, first there was... I forgot all the acronyms now, guys. I'm sorry. Let me think about it for a second here. The Syrian National Council, right, was one of them, and then it was the Syrian National Committee or whatever. Something like that. A different attempt at the same thing. And in both cases, the leaders turned around and endorsed Al-Qaeda and said, we are loyal to the goals of Ayman al-Zawahiri. Sorry, America, but that's the only shot we've got at credibility over here, is if we declare our loyalty to your enemies. And the same thing with the Free Syrian Army, such as it's ever existed. And you know what? I should get Flint Leverett on the show and really pin him down on this specific issue. And I think I forgot to ask him this when I interviewed him the other day. Or maybe I asked him so many damn things that he never got to this specific point. But did you guys notice how funny it was how all of a sudden there was this thing called the Islamic Front? Oh, yeah, the FSA got completely obliterated and driven right out of Syria at the end of December, beginning of the year. No such FSA anymore. And then all of a sudden, there's this group called the Islamic Front. They're not the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They're not the Jabhat al-Nusra. They're the Islamic Front. And I guess there are different, you know, small militias over there. But it seems to me, and I forget now my best footnote for this. I was just reading this the other day. Oh, I know what it is. No, man. It's Daniel McAdams wrote about this at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and he links to blogs of... No, not blogs of war. The Long War Journal, which is a pro-terror war blog. But it was good information there, and it was about how the so-called Islamic Front is really just a name for al-Nusra. And that what's happened is they just had a few of their guys start calling themselves something else, so that they can go and collect American weaponry from Jordan and swear that, yeah, they believe in Allah and everything, but it's not like they're a suicide bomber about it or anything like that. And then they get the weapons and then they go back and lo and behold, here's Jabhat al-Nusra firing American wire-guided TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles. That's the hop, skip, and a jump. It's just a hop. That's it. It's one hop. You don't even get to the skip or the jump. That's it. America gives the weapons to the Islamic front, and then it is just al-Nusra. You know? They don't even pass it on to al-Nusra. They are al-Nusra. Sure seems to me. Maybe that's a little bit of an oversimplification. I'm not claiming I've memorized the name of every would-be militia over there, or, you know, their troop strength or whatever, but the whole insurgency has clearly been dominated this whole time by ISIS and Nusra. And isn't it just amazing? It's absolutely amazing to me the way that the media, I mean, never mind, oh yeah, Saddam is a big threat because, you know, conceivably, I guess if he had chemical weapons, he could give some to Al-Qaeda and they could kill some civilians with it or something. And that's a hell of a lie to go along with, but it's at least it sort of could be plausible, but for the media to go along with this story that Al-Qaeda is bad in Iraq but good in Syria and they're the very same men this whole time, that they could arm them here and bewail they're getting arms there at the very same moment? Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, so, yeah, I really think I'm right that new jihadi stan here, the new Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, will be the next major American intervention. They just can't leave it like this. They're going to put boots on the ground there. They're going to have to, I think. And as Michael Scheuer said in an interview the other week, the intervention in Nigeria may just cause a crisis so bad that it necessitates, like actually necessitates an intervention from any sort of statist point of view, just because America gets approximately 20% of our daily oil from Nigeria. So if there's major disruptions in those oil supplies, they will go to war. So I don't necessarily mean need from my point of view or yours, but from the empire's point of view, they certainly could. If they can make the situation, they are bad enough. And so now my challenge is, can I do the Woodrow Wilson speech in 8 minutes here and bring you right up to date? Because honestly, I think my Woodrow Wilson speech is a bit out of date. But see, the thing is World War I was a stalemate until Woodrow Wilson got the U.S. involved. And then that tipped the balance so far in favor of the British and the French that they were able to dictate terms to the Germans and to the Ottomans that, of course, ended up, as everyone knows, as we all learn even in government school, I think I did when I was a kid, that the terms of the peace at the end of the First World War set the stage for the rise of the Nazis in World War II. And they go into less detail, but I think, as we all know, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the British and the French took over the Middle East. The British expanded their empire by 1 million square miles. And, of course, all of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire was thrown into complete disarray and et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, American intervention in the war, prolonging the war, and Woodrow Wilson's direct foreign aid to the Kerensky government, the post-revolution, the post-March 1917 revolution government in Russia kept Kerensky in the war. And so, two things. That completely destroyed the last of his popular support. Even though he wasn't the Tsar and people hated the Tsar, he kept the army in the war. So that destroyed the last of his support. And then also, the army was not there to protect Moscow. And so, Lenin and Trotsky, on their fourth try, were able to seize the government and create the USSR and enslave hundreds of millions of people and create world communism, which is probably the worst mistake of a belief system that people ever decided to subscribe to, and paid for it with their lives by the hundreds of millions, well, tens of millions, more than 100 million. Anyway, so, of course, this is all setting the stage for World War II. So without Woodrow Wilson, no Nazi Germany, no Soviet Union, and no World War II. And also then, no Maoist China, no domino theory, no Cold War, no American Empire, not like this anyway, because we'd have had all the European powers still in our government's way. And then that would also mean no Vietnam War. It would also mean no support for the Shah Pahlavi in Iran. That would have been the British's problem, not ours. And then no support for Saddam Hussein to contain the blowback, the Iranian revolution there. No support for Osama bin Laden and the Arab and Afghan Mujahideen who fought the Soviets in the 1980s. And then no angry Osama bin Laden after America occupied Arabia in order to kick Saddam, their ally, who they tricked into invading Kuwait, out. And then no Clinton blockade, no fly zone bombings. Oh, I skipped. No Israel, no World War I, no Israel, none of America's support, and no World War II, no Israel, and no Truman, and no American, you know, war guarantee forever for the Israelis to do whatever they want to whoever they want. And then no terrorism, no 9/11. But instead what we got was 9/11, which then became the excuse for this much more intervention. And as we can see from dealing with the blowback from each last interventions, and I guess I skipped a few in there, Korea and whatever, but you can see by trying to deal with the consequences of all of our last interventions, they just lead to the next crisis, to the next crisis, to the next crisis. So here, Iran has been greatly empowered by Bush's invasion of Iraq, which just has made the Saudis double down on their support for Mujahideen across the region. And then the guys who lost the vanguard of the warriors who fought on the Sunni side against the Americans and the Iranians and the Shiite Iraqis, a lot of them went home, back to Libya, back to Syria, and started up those wars. Then America goes, and you can't even call this cleaning up the mess. If they were cleaning up the mess, they would have been paying Assad and Gaddafi extra to kill these guys more. And instead, in both cases, they went with Ariel Sharon's, you know, at that time, half a corpse wishes that, no, Assad and Gaddafi have to go too. And never mind what we've learned about what's going to take their place when they're gone. And in both cases, then they go and they get rid of Gaddafi. And they spread jihad from Libya down into Mali and down into Nigeria. And they've turned Boko Haram from a group of bark-eating crazies, you know, sort of like Kissinger did to the Khmer Rouge. They were a bunch of nobodies until our intervention turned them into somebodies, radicalized the hell out of them, gave them some battlefield experience and some command and control and some new and better weapons. And now they're a whole different force to be reckoned with than they ever were before. And, of course, the consequences of the war going on in Syria right now, the blowback from that is only just beginning. And you can see it with the American suicide bomber who went and died in Syria 2 weeks ago, killing himself to kill some people. And a Frenchman who had gone to Syria to fight in the jihad for ISIS and then came back and killed two Jews at a museum in Brussels. This is only just the very beginning of the blowback from American intervention in Syria. And so, probably if I had jotted down a couple of notes, I could have done that a little bit better. But that basically, I think, in a nutshell, just goes to show that this is all Woodrow Wilson's fault. That every time a group of American politicians and militarists decide that they're going to solve the problem that their last intervention created, they just create, usually they make matters worse just in the first place, but then secondly, they create the circumstances for their next intervention to just keep kicking the can down the road, and then it never works. They never restore stability or liberty or goodness to anywhere. And there's a great new Tom Dispatch article. It'll be running on antiwar.com tomorrow. That's his point, too. There is not a single good thing that is ever going to come of any of this. You cannot tell me just one more intervention in the new jihadi stand in the former Syria and Iraq. You can't tell me one more intervention in Nigeria to just nip this thing in the bud. Because, as I've just proven, history shows that it only makes matters worse. All we can do is just knock it off. Just quit. That's how to win the war on terrorism. Just stop it.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is James Ridgway. Last we spoke with him, he'd written all about Jesse Trenadue and the Oklahoma bombing for Mother Jones Magazine. But now he's working with this group, Solitary Watch. The website is solitarywatch.com. News from a nation in lockdown. Welcome back to the show, James. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Yep. All right, so I guess, well, first of all, before we get to the news, just go ahead and tell us all about the project.
Well, Solitary Watch, a website and a project that I started several years ago and now run with my colleague Jean Casella. And the aim of it is to bring to public attention the details and the existence even of the 80,000 people in the United States who live in solitary confinement, that is, who are locked up in solitary confinement in prisons all over the place. They sort of are black sites, and nobody knows much about them, and they're secret, really. The press can't get into them. We've tried to get into them ourselves to look around and, you know, see what they're like. And we've been turned down. And no lawyer wants the case because they think they'll come up against the Supreme Court and other courts or other courts and get turned down. So it just remain these sort of secret little pockets, 6x8 cells. The people can live in there from, what, a day, a week, a month, or in the case of some people in Louisiana, 40 years. That's 40 years. Like, think of it, 40 years living in a closet or in your bathroom. Try it. Go to your bathroom for the weekend, lock yourself in, see how long it takes before you go nuts. So 40 years until you get out a couple of times a week, maybe to have a shower, and once or twice a week to have recreation in a dog kennel run. And each time you move, you're shackled by the feet, you're handcuffed, and wear a belly chain. And you sort of go down tiers. And the other people on you are throwing feces at you and screaming and yelling. And so you go down to your shower, and you're always watching in your shower to be sure somebody doesn't stab them. And or you go to the recreation where you do the same thing. You gotta watch out, you're not going to get stabbed.
All right, now James, so, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but your phone is really kind of cutting out on me. I wonder if you can maybe try to hold it with as little contact with your hand as possible. Maybe stand near a window or something, because I really want to make sure that people can hear you well. And you're kind of cutting out on us.
Okay.
But you sounded all right at first, so I think it should be okay, you know, if we can try to adjust there. But then, I'm sorry to interrupt, because there's a very important point where you're at, where people are being driven crazy by being in solitary confinement, but then it's not like they get transferred to the mental hospital after that or anything. Not like that would be all that much better, but then that just means that you just have, you know, a whole cell block full of madmen.
Yeah, exactly. And right now I'm dealing with people like a guy who has cystic fibrosis, and they won't give him his medicine. And he said, he's going to die anyhow, but now he's dying quicker. A guy who is a thalidomide baby, he's got one arm longer than the other, one leg shorter than the other, a couple of fingers on one hand, a few more fingers on the other hand, and he can't clean himself when he goes to the toilet. And he's being locked up and held in solitary for a lot of the time because he's trying to get painkillers, and they won't give him painkillers, so he stole some painkillers, and he had a revolver. I guess he was holding people up to get painkillers so he could ease the pain of this situation, which is pretty horrible. So these guys are all over the place. There, some of them are disabled. Some of them are just crazy. I mean, they've been driven crazy. There are people who are put in there. Who I have another guy that I work with who is a young man who's tried to kill himself 50 times. And they got in a carjack situation. They put him in jail. And so he immediately tried to electrocute himself. He failed at that. So then he burned his cell down, or tried to burn his cell down. So what did the prison people do? They put him up in front of the grand jury in the city of Utica, and they indicted him and found him guilty of arson. Yeah. So now he's stuck for many more years, and he's cutting himself every day. He sends me a letter once a week or so, tells me how he's cutting himself, asks me please not to stress his mom, but he says I'm going to go all the way as soon as I can, okay?
Now,
so this guy,
now, James, I'm sorry, but I just I want to make sure that people are on the same page here and understand it, because I have to admit that, you know, as you first started talking here, there's, you know, part of me is saying, but yeah, you know what, though, we're talking about really bad guys. And, you know, I'm not much of a true crime buff. That's more the wife's territory. But there are people who do and I mean non-government employees who do absolutely horrible things to people, to each other, to children. Things where I don't mind seeing them hanged or locked in solitary. Some of these guys, I just can't possibly feel sorry for them. But it sounds to me like my point is already moot, because what you're saying is the badness of the crimes is not the measure of what gets people locked in solitary confinement. You might just have a distraught kid who set his own cell on fire in desperation, and that is his horrible crime. Or somebody who, like you said, did a hold up out of desperation because the government wouldn't let him have a prescription for his pain medicine. So he's not a career criminal. He's not out there trying to, you know, enter into the drug black market. He's one guy who had a really, really bad day and took it out on other people in a way that there should be some mercy there. But instead, no, he goes to the hole. And that's the thing of it, is that we imagine, because we watch TV, we imagine that it's a Perry Mason, Matlock kind of a situation. There's fairness in all the process. If it was really, if what was happening to them in jail was really that wrong, they would get a court to address it, and it would, and the system works, and this kind of thing. But that's what you're telling me is no, Scott. When you read about the very worst child rapist murderer, he's not the guy in solitary. He's over there on cell block C. It's some other guy who really never did anything to anybody who's over there in solitary. For basically what would seem to you and me to be arbitrary reasons.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Scott. I mean, the thing is, we know a guy. We know a guy, for example, he had too many stamps. They're allowed a certain number of stamps. He had too many stamps, so he's put in a hole. You know, another guy who was eating an apple. He ate an apple and he ate the core of the apple. Put him in the hole because they said the core of the apple contained arsenic. So he's trying to poison himself.
What?
I mean, this stuff goes on all over the place. Some of it's very small. But our general point is that no matter what happens, you know, what goes on, the human being is okay, so he's taken, has his liberty taken from him. but he should be treated as a human being at some basic level.
Right.
You know?
And yeah, yeah, anyhow, and I don't mean to say that, you know, if somebody, I really don't care how someone who's a rapist or a torturer type murderer is treated, because the fact is, no matter how bad they, I may think they deserve mistreatment, or I personally don't mind if something bad happens to them, no one has the authority, the legitimate authority, to mistreat them in the first place. And so that is the much more important point, that the jailer's job is to protect their rights, to keep them confined, but to protect their rights other than that, as you say. And no one has the legitimate authority to treat them any less than that. So now, I'm sorry, because the music's playing, James, and we got to go out and take this break. But hang tight right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with James Ridgway from Solitary Watch, this very important project. 80,000 Americans. 80,000 Americans in solitary right now. Can you believe that?
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network, weekdays noon to 3 Eastern Time, LRN.FM. You can find all my interview archives and all the rest of my stuff at scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And I'm in the middle of talking with James Ridgway from Solitary Watch. And this is such an important project, because this is just such a... I don't know. It's such a horrible part of our society, of what's going on in it. You know, I think it's sort of like the Bush/Obama torture program too. When people justify this kind of thing, it ends up tainting their souls and making them worse people too. You know, it kind of poisons our whole society that we, and I mean that in a collective kind of way, that we allow these kinds of systems to exist, that this is the way that we deal with each other, locking people in solitary. And James, someone just sent me a tweet the other day that said, you know what's good about Guantanamo Bay is it's not Pelican Bay. Because you go to Pelican Bay, you spend your first 15 years in solitary. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, they say that people are talking now about how Guantanamo is better than places like Pelican Bay and a lot of these other places.
It's just, but you know,
Scott, one of the things you haven't talked about, which is worth thinking about, are these judges, because the judges set the terms on all this stuff. You know, they set the big terms, and then, you know, they're implemented by the corrections people. But the judges can make it possible, you know, to go down and look and see what's going on. If you were able to actually go in and see what solitary confinement amounted to, what it was, it would begin to change it. You know, the British have 40 people in solitary. And they have a system where you go into a community where there's a prison, and they just select almost at random a dozen people, townspeople, and they give each person a key to the jail. And they can go into that jail morning, noon, or night. They talk to these guys, these inmates, 3 or 4 times a week. And they settle all the petty stuff. You know, the guy with the apple red arsenic, they get him out immediately. So you have townspeople being part of the whole thing. Here it's all locked up, it's all frightened, it's run by these locals from big unions, big liberal unions, SEIU, AFSCME. They're in the forefront of this stuff, you know? Nobody
right.
knows that, and nobody pays any attention to it.
Well, and it's such an important thing because, you know, people want to just, you know, even right-wingers want to, they sort of kind of side with unions, if only because, you know, they don't really understand economics, and also because everybody likes the working man and the lower middle class and the upper lower class and these kind of guys. We like, that's the salt to the earth and the strength of America and these kinds of things. People want to side with them, and so they don't want to look critically at the fact that these guys are such rent seekers, and I guess they're no worse than the iron bar manufacturers or the quarries that dig up the concrete or Anheuser-Busch or whatever, but they just shamelessly, all these groups just shamelessly lobby for more criminalization of every kind of human behavior, for the enslavement of their own society, for their own narrow self-interest at the expense of the rest of us. Like, they just can't figure out anything else to build except prisons, or anything else to guard except other human beings being locked away from the rest of us, you know?
Well, that's right. It's absolutely right.
It's sad.
And it's true that conservatives, political conservatives, are in an odd sort of way, or unexpected way, are beginning to take, you know, a real interest in this subject. But, you know, the liberals always just say, well, let's tinker with the edges of it and we'll get it fixed. But then nothing ever changes. But some of the conservative Republicans who are big in Congress have actually taken, you know, a serious interest. And, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll be able to get things changed.
Yeah.
But I think the judges are a big problem.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, because they really do have a lot of discretion when it comes to dictating the terms of confinement here, don't they?
You know, because a judge could go down and look at these places, walk in anytime he felt like it. And I remember just William Katzenbach, you know, the former attorney general under Johnson, he just before he died, he wrote this thing and he said, I got, you know, some suggestions on the solitary. First thing is get law professors to take their classes down there, you know, all the time. And the second thing is to get the judge to walk down and take a look at it. And, you know, maybe if the judges all went down and saw what they're doing, what happens? You know, when you get on a jury, they always say, you know, they say, well, you just convict a guy, and you say, well, what's he going to get? And they say, that's none of your business. Don't talk about it. Well, it is your business. You got a right to know what's going to happen to these people. I mean, if the guy's got 22 stamps instead of 20 and he's going to be locked in the hole, of course it's your business. So I don't know what I really feel strongly that somehow or other the judges ought to be questioned.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the thing of it is, too, is it's people so often they can excuse things and deflect responsibility just by, you know, kind of turns of phrase like, well, he knew that would be what happens, right? People say that about if you want to quit the army. Hey, you knew that you're not allowed to quit when you signed up. Yeah, but so what? Still, you should still be able to quit anyway. It's still right that you should be able to quit if you want, right? But people just kind of, they figure out kind of a cliche to deploy or whatever. Well, he knew the rule was 20 stamps, and so blah, blah, blah. And a judge especially, you know, has no problem rationalizing stuff like that away. And I think the best example of this that I know of from recently, James, would be this Eugene Jarecki documentary about the drug war, The House I Live In, where he has an extended interview with this federal judge who talks about basically what an evil criminal conspirator he is in mass kidnapping of innocent people. And he just sits there saying, yes, that's right. I know it's wrong, and I don't care. I get up every day, and I put people in prison for decades for stupid drug crimes that should not be crimes. And it's wrong that Congress won't give me enough discretion, because if they would give me discretion, I might give a guy a year. But instead, I happily give him 30 years, each and every day in, day out. And hey, if you don't like it, talk to your legislature, basically is his attitude. He can rationalize this away, destroying human beings. He might as well be murdering them. And yet to him, well, you know, whatever. Hey, man, this is my job. And look at my black robe. Isn't it official and justified? Self-justifying, even?
Yeah, well, all the judge has to do is quit. I mean,
right.
You know, he didn't have to do that. I mean, you know, that's the whole thing with the Nazis and stuff. I mean, you know, you don't have to do any of this stuff. You can walk off the job anytime you feel like it. These judges never walk off of anything because they get a lot of money. A lot of them are elected in elections. You know, it's just another part of the political machine. Mm.
All right, now, so talk to me more about the psychological effects of solitary confinement, because, and this is basically sensory deprivation, right?
Yeah, well, you can talk, you can, it's hard to, I told you about the guy who's trying to kill himself, okay?
Right.
And so he's up there, right now, he's up there, he's trying to kill himself. And sooner or later, you know, you say, so his mother said, you know, she went up to see him, and she saw all these marks on his arm, you know, cut marks on his arms and stuff. She finally called up the head shrink, He's in a mental unit. He's locked into a mental unit. People don't understand that in these mental units, they're solitary. You know, you can get locked into a hospital room. So she calls him up and says, you know, my son is going crazy, going to kill himself. And the head guy says, and she says, put him in, he's got to go to a psychiatric hospital. He's got to be examined, you know. Maybe there's a way to help him. And the head guy says, he's not going anywhere. So,
all right, well,
you know, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah. Well, again, it's just like you said earlier. Anyone can imagine. Just go in your closet and now imagine spending decades in there, or even a year, even a month in there. And how would you feel in that situation? It's crazy. All right, now, I'm sorry, in the very last short amount of time we have here, can you talk about some of the activism, how people can help support, how they can get involved in Solitary Watch?
Yeah, the single best thing is to talk to the prisoners. Stop talking to all these organizations and stop talking to their officials. You know, try to make contact with the actual prisoners. They're the ones that actually know what's going on. They're the reporters on the front lines, and then to their families. The more people do that, the better the thing will get, because then more people will know about it. But right now, it's just a sealed up, it's like a tomb. You can't find out anything about it. You don't know anything about it. Whatever you hear might be hearsay, might be wrong, might be right. You don't know. You don't have a clue.
Yep.
So the more you talk to the prisoners, the better off you are.
Right. Yeah, this has got to go to the top of the list of priorities for the human rights types in this country immediately. SolitaryWatch.com, James Ridgway. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact, there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all. So there's so much talk about, I kind of just want to do nothing but talk about ISIS. Maybe I should do nothing but talk about ISIS. First of all, I have to apologize for Moscow there. Of course, I meant St. Petersburg, and I knew when I said Moscow that it wasn't Moscow, but for some reason St. Petersburg wasn't in my brain at the time, so I just kept talking. But thank you to Mirko in the chat room for pointing out my mistake there. Oh yeah, I really know what I'm talking about. You can trust me. Oops. Anyway. So there's my correction of the day. Hopefully it'll be the only one. And yeah, I do hope that you guys will check out Solitary Watch. This really should be a priority of libertarians and of all human rights types and anti-war types and anti-government types and anti-everything that's unjust types, right? Anybody who's active in political life, broadly defined. Can't we all sign on to this? If you're Southern Baptists, can't you sign on to this with Rick Perry, you know? Can't the Christian right find it in their hearts to knock off this thing? Can't everyone except for the unions and the iron bar manufacturers and Anheuser-Busch and the other directly interested interest groups, can't we all just agree that, yeah, no, it shouldn't be like this? I don't mean it should have to be a federal law or whatever. It should be the 50 states. But what we need is consensus among the people that, you know what? All this, you know, we demand that government be the toughest tough guys, tough as can be against criminals and all that. Yeah, we didn't really mean lock them in tiny broom closets in total isolation from each other for decades. That, yeah, no. Keep them, throw them in the hole and keep them there. Not quite. what we wanted. And even if it is what you wanted, still, change your mind. It ain't right, man. And you shouldn't pretend that you really have the authority to delegate to the government to do that to somebody. That's the whole theory here, right? That the people come first and they create the government to be their security force. There's no divine right of kings in America. It's popular sovereignty, didn't you learn in school? And so that means that any authority the government has are a derivative of your rights. Authority that you presumably, I'm not saying I believe in this, you know, hocus pocus, basically, but the theory goes for the American government, you know, that its powers come from your rights and your authority to, for example, defend yourself or even confine someone who has, you know, basically, I don't know the exact Rothbardian terminology for it or whatever, but given up their rights by aggressing against someone else. Aggressing against you. You got the right to confine someone who tried to kill you, right? Something like that. I don't know exactly how that works, but they have the right to defend you because you have the right to defend yourself. But you don't have the right to torture and abuse people under any circumstances, and so you don't have the right, you don't have the authority to delegate that authority because you don't have it in the first place. That's kind of the thing. That's sort of the theory of the whole Bill of Rights, if you get it, you know? Except for the Fifth Amendment has positive rights. The rest of it is all government has to leave you alone. They don't have the right to tell you which church you have to go to. And they don't have the right to stop you from going to whichever church you want. And they don't have the right. They don't have any legitimate authority to tell you what you can't say on your own property or upon the commons. Or to prevent you from associating with who you wish to associate. And then, I guess, petition for redress or grievances, that's more of a civil right, that you can sue them when they violate your rights. That's what that's supposed to mean, even though now it means sign your name to a piece of paper on a website or a website and get nowhere with anything. They don't have the right to take your guns. They don't have the right to put soldiers in your house. They don't have the right to put cops in your house, at least unless they're investigating a specific crime and can prove to a judge, the cops, have to prove to a judge that they have at least a probable cause to believe they will find evidence of the crime that they're investigating on your property. And they have to specifically define what it is that they think they're going to find there, too. And the reason why that they think they're going to find it. That's the civil construct for allowed violations. If they are, in fact, investigating, say, for example, your violation of someone else's rights, then under those checks and balances, under this construct, they have the authority to come in and look around. I'm not saying it's perfect, but still, you can see it's derivative of your right to not be aggressed against is still where they get that right, is investigating crimes of aggression. And then the whole thing with the Fifth Amendment, and there are a few different protections in there, such as against torture. Really, that's the protection from self-incrimination. I plead the Fifth, Your Honor. That's a protection from torture. Because if they can make you confess, then they'll figure out a way to make you confess. So that's supposed to be just off the table in the first place. That way they don't torture you. Basically, that's what's going on there. That protection is, again, you know, reaffirmed in the Eighth Amendment ban against cruel and unusual punishment. Which, be careful, because Scalia will get real technical on you. Strict construction and say, hey, it doesn't ban cruel and unusual interrogation, just punishment. Damn. Look out for that Scalia, man. He'll get you. He'll torture your ass. And then your right to a lawyer, that's a positive right, a civil right, rather than a natural right being protected, but it's in order that, you know, hey, if they're going to violate your liberty and lock you in a cage or do whatever it is to you as your punishment, that at least you get something like a fair chance to defend yourself. Again, that Matlock or Perry Mason ideal that everybody believes in but doesn't really exist except on Matlock and Perry Mason. But that's the way it's supposed to work, that they can't use secret evidence against you, that they can't just stand you up there completely outmatched by a professional government lawyer with an unlimited budget but without the ability to interpret the law or how to argue it in court yourself. So you get a lawyer there, blah, blah, blah. Sixth Amendment, that's actually a continuation. It was the seventh I was thinking of. The Sixth Amendment is a continuation of the Fifth Amendment, the processes and protections, jury trials, and all that from the Fifth Amendment. It's basically one big amendment, really, five and six. And then the Seventh Amendment is jury trials for civil suits of at least over a couple hundred bucks, that kind of thing. That again, that's more of a civil process than any kind of natural right, but it's an attempt to guarantee fairness in protection of property rights, so that if the state is going to side with a plaintiff against the defendant has the right to really demonstrate why it should not be so before, you know, presumably disinterested members of his community, right? And then the Eighth Amendment is a protection from torture and from excessive bail, except that's just gone. And I don't know all the court cases that served as the precedents for it, but they'll put an absolutely impossible bail on anyone for anything nowadays just because they feel like it. Which, you know, Dan Ellsberg points out that after he was indicted, he got to travel the country for a year and a half or two pleading his case, giving speeches and whatever, whatever, out on bond. But Edward Snowden would never get that chance, just like James Ridgway was explaining about the special administrative measures and secrecy under an Espionage Act indictment. He would be buried in the deepest pit. We would never hear from him again. Who knows if they'd even let him attend his own trial at this point. They certainly would not let him. They certainly, absolutely, certainly would not let him argue a whistleblower defense in court. That he broke the law, but only to tell the people the truth that the government was breaking the constitutional law and that they needed to know. And therefore, that's why you ought to acquit me. He will not be allowed to argue that in court, no matter what. And then, of course, the Ninth Amendment is just a reminder that this is supposed to be a list of declaratory and restrictive clauses by the people who are already free against the government that they created to protect their freedom, supposedly. So just because this is a list of some restrictions against you doesn't mean it's the total list of our rights. And then the 10th says that any power we don't expressly delegate to the national government does not belong to it, period. So there, the Bill of Rights that no longer exists. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These PNAC clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Now, this is old news if you're a regular listener to this show. I think Robert Perry has done the best work on it up until now. And it's old news, but it's important. Apparently, it's new to a lot of people, I guess, from the way I read this. The way it's written. And, you know, you never know what's going to turn people on, man. What's going to get their brain really moving. About, geez, is it really that bad? Yeah, it is. If your brain didn't explode earlier when I talked about how Congress never held a single hearing on McVeigh's friends after the biggest thing that ever happened since the end of World War II or whatever in this country at the time, it was. Sure seemed like. If that didn't blow your mind... Yes, Nixon scuttled the Vietnam peace talks, and this is the story that you may have heard before, and here it is, double, triple, extra, reconfirmed, that Richard Nixon sent this lady, Anna, what's her name again? Oh, hell, I should have paged down and reminded myself, because I always forget her name. Anna Chenault, that's it. See how she's got this French name, but she's a Vietnamese lady, so, of course, that's obvious, right? But... my stupid brain always falls down on the job when it comes to that. I always try to think of an Asian last name for her, but I can't ever come up with one because her last name is Chenault. Anyway, Anna Chenault was sent to tell the South Vietnamese, sent by Nixon and Kissinger. And again, you know, not again.
for the first time, in case you didn't know. Nixon hadn't been in an official position of power since 1960. Well, the very beginning of 1961. He lost, well, I mean, really, Kennedy stole the election in 1960 from him. Then he went home and he lost a run for governor. And then he sat around waiting. Let Rockefeller and Goldwater and I forget one other guy, have the big fight in 64 and sat that one out. And then in 68, here he was nothing like an official, in an official position of power whatsoever. And yet he and Kissinger sent this lady, Anna Chenault, to tell the South, to tattletale basically, to the South Vietnamese so-called government, the sock puppet government in Saigon, that LBJ was negotiating with the North Vietnamese behind their back. And then, so they raised a big stink about it, and they sabotaged the talks, and the talks went nowhere. And it's on tape of, which I don't have the, oh, do I? Is it right here? Do we have the audio here? Let me see. Oh, yeah. Let's see. Play it. Is it going to play? Here you go. Johnson and Everett Dirksen. Is it playing? What the hell? Oh, here.
Everett, how are you?
All right. I want to talk to you as a friend and very confidentially because I think that we're skirting on dangerous ground, and I thought I ought to give you the facts, and you ought to pass them on if you choose. If you don't, why, then I will a little later.
Yeah.
Both Chu and Key stressed on us the importance of a minimum delay.
Yeah.
Then we got some of our friends involved.
Uh-huh.
Some of it your old China crowd.
Yeah.
And here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they've just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. That just hold on until after the election. Are some of our folks, including some of the old China lobby, are going to the Vietnamese embassy and saying, please notify the president that if he'll hold out till November the 2nd, they could get a better deal.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
I don't know whether it's Laird. I don't know who it is that is putting it out. But here is the UPI 48 that came in tonight.
Yeah.
And I'm calling you only after talking to Rusk and Clifford and all of them who thought that somebody ought to be notified as to what's happening.
All right, so there you go. The boss, that's Richard Nixon, and telling the South Vietnamese, just hold out. Don't negotiate with President Johnson. Just hold out till after the election. And Johnson says, this is treason. And isn't it? Let's see. Does that count as direct aid and comfort to the enemy? Maybe it's not technically treason, but boy, oh boy, is that the worst thing that Richard Nixon ever did. And then, of course, the bottom line is, and you know, this was in the Christopher Hitchens documentary about Henry Kissinger from years ago, all about this. And the point is that Nixon ended up coming to the exact same terms only 6 years later. 1974. The exact same terms. So, and, you know, the majority of the American killed there, and probably the majority of the Vietnamese killed there, were killed after this, you know? Or, I don't know, 64 through 68. That's a hell of a lot of bombing, too. But the way Nixon expanded into Laos and Cambodia, again, back to my chain of events earlier, setting the stage for the Khmer Rouge takeover there. Yeah, man. Anyway, I mean, they killed, but never mind Pol Pot. They kill, and of course, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan both backed Pol Pot. They sided with Pol Pot against Vietnam, against communist Vietnam. But the Johnson-Nixon administration, both, I guess the Nixon administration, had killed a million-something Cambodians and Laotians before the Khmer Rouge ever came to power. And there you just heard it in Johnson's own words. This is treason. This is the Republican campaign just went and undermined the U.S. president's peace negotiations. I just read a thing the other day by Ben Stein about what a great peacemaker Richard Nixon was and how everybody hates him and everybody smears him and everybody creates this mean old caricature. But look, he shook hands with Mao, which you have to admit is certainly the greatest thing he ever did in his entire miserable life. But then even after that, he went and signed an arms limitation treaty with the Russians to not rub their nose in it too damn bad. That's a pretty good point, too. He and Kissinger ushered in detente with the Soviet Union at the same time that they split off China from him, or at least exploited the split that already existed. So, you know, that is pretty good. But, yeah, I don't think Ben Stein even mentioned Vietnam in there. Or only in, oh, yeah, he came in and he ended Vietnam. Oh, yeah, only after dropping an entire World War II worth of bombs from the air. Only after killing another couple of million human beings did he finally go ahead and lose anyway. Secret plan to end the war. So Ben Stein is right, that screw Watergate, but look at what it was really about. In fact, doesn't Perry say that this is what they're trying to protect? This secret of Nixon's treason? Huh? Huh? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, you know, I don't know, man. I guess I should be talking about Ukraine. But Syria. You know what? I don't know, man. My gut isn't always right about everything, but usually it's pretty good about stuff like this. And I got a real bad feeling about the future of this ISIS thing. And maybe even for the near term. And I wonder, I saw tweets of somewhat, at least, intellectually honest people going back and forth today speculating that, listen, they're going to have to change their whole tune on Assad and the Syrian rebels after what's happening today in Iraq. I mean, they'll have to, right? And that's what I think, too. I mean, how, I don't know. Then again, it's unreal. It's almost unbelievable the way that they've been able to say, support the rebels. Yes, it's true, the rebels are Al-Qaeda, but still, hey, support the rebels, as though they didn't just admit that the rebels are Al-Qaeda. They just go right on. Remember me the other day mocking Chuck Todd because the way he handled his cognitive dissonance was he says, isn't it funny how Al-Qaeda's on our side in this one? Even though, of course, it's their war. And the whole debate was whether, I mean, from his point of view, not that America hadn't been backing it all along, don't get me wrong, but from his point of view, the question was whether America should intervene to help these guys more or not. But then he still can only construct it in terms of them helping us, because otherwise he'd be accusing Barack Obama of supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria, which is exactly the truth. And there are now thousands of these guys. And, you know, I don't like to cite the Rand Corporation study, but you know what? Damn it, it confirms my belief. And so I'm confirmation biased as hell about it. You read it and you tell me what you think about it, but it's called A Persistent Threat, the Evolution of Al-Qaeda and Other Salafi Jihadists. And I think the State Department, recent State Department terrorism report along the same lines, is also correct, that there are now more and more of these guys, thousands and thousands of these guys, and Syria is their real center of gravity. Syria now, especially back in Iraq again. Oh, for now at least, they own Mosul. And then here's footnote of all footnotes. I mean, if you don't like it, then I don't know what to tell you. That's fine. But for me, this is the end all. It's Patrick Coburn. And Patrick Coburn wrote a 5-part series about Al-Qaeda about 2 months ago for The Independent, and it's all reprinted at the UNS Review at UNS.com. You could look at that too. But it's there at independent.co.uk. Just type in Patrick Coburn, 5-part series, Al-Qaeda, something like that. You'll find it. And if he says so, then yeah. And now he's got two new ones. In the war on terrorism, only Al-Qaeda thrives. And then from yesterday, the battle to establish Islamic State across Iraq and Syria. So there's, you know, the State Department, Rand, Scheuer, Giraldi, Landay, Coburn. Everybody whose judgment that I trust the best on this, you decide however you want. All these guys are saying, yeah, this is a problem. I absolutely, again, just in case there's any mistake, I would want to preempt it. I'm 100% with Giraldi on this one. The only way to win the war on terrorism is to stop. I am not advocating an invasion of new Jihadistan between Syria and Iraq. I'm just telling you that our past few invasions have sure as hell create a giant safe haven, really, honestly, a proto-state for Al-Qaeda, suicide bomber, bin Ladenite crazies. After all, you know, people who see the world the way bin Laden saw it, in the broad strokes, they still weren't that many, but they're, you know, spread around the region. What made, and there were, you know, would-be Sunni-based insurgencies all over the place in the Middle East against whether their dictator is Assad, the pseudo-Shiite Alawite Baathist, or Sunni Saddam Hussein, or Hosni Mubarak, or the kings Abdullah in Jordan and Saudi Arabia, or all the different emirs and sultans of the Arabian coast there, right? What made bin Laden unique was he and Zawahiri had this agreement. They would move, basically they took over the Azzam group, and then they merged the Azzam group with Egyptian Islamic Jihad, the Saudi and Egyptian kind of partnership here. And what made them unique was their agreement to attack the far enemy, the United States, because they determined that as long as America backed all their local dictators, it would make it so much harder for them to overthrow them. And so even though there were would-be jihads everywhere from Morocco to Pakistan, how are they ever going to get anywhere as long as America's bankrolling them all? And so let's go ahead, and then you've heard this one a million times, and it's as true as ever. True as could be. They wanted to replicate what America helped them do to the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s by luring the United States in there, bogging us down, bleeding us to bankruptcy. And then, as Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, the invasion of Iraq was just the icing on the cake. That was the hoped-for but unexpected gift to bin Laden, that they would overthrow the man that bin Laden called the socialist infidel, Saddam Hussein, and turn at least the Sunni provinces of Iraq into lawless jihadistan this whole damn time. For the last 11 years now. Is more than he could have ever hoped for. And then for Obama to double down, to do what he did in Libya, and to back the rebellion in Syria like this. Again, I'm not saying, as Scheuer says, America should have kept back in Saddam. America should be, Margulies even says, we should be back in Assad right now. I'm not for that. I'm not for the U.S. government's existence or activity. Period. That's it. Activities? No. No activities. No verbs out of any of you guys at all. That's it. Just stop everything that you're doing, including showing up to work in the morning. That's it. No more from you. You're the ones who made it this way. I'm not advocating that kind of intervention, but boy, have they created a hell of a lot of enemies. I think, you know, they'll dry up. If the American intervention ceases, I mean, after all, they've won. They've broken our economy. It's just getting the American government to realize it. They've proven that the American people will not tolerate a decades-long occupation over there. Zawahiri lamented, no, we don't want them to withdraw yet. We want them to only leave after we killed 300,000 of them and broken their banking system, their budget completely. We don't want a partial withdrawal. We want to bog them down forever. So the more intervention that we do over there, it just makes their job easier. And it seems to me like since the last, you know, more than a generation of foreign policy in the Middle East should have been hands off and politely encouraging, you know, reformation and that kind of thing, but otherwise not intervening. We screwed everything up so bad. I don't know how long it'll take for things to start heading the right direction over there, but certainly our government cannot make things better. Not by fighting Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, and not by fighting ISIS and al-Nusra in Syria, and not by fighting Boko Haram in Nigeria, not by fighting the last group of jihadist holdouts in the mountains of Mali, or in the northwestern tribal territories of Pakistan. Yes, there will always be an angry Sunni man with a rifle. But we got to just knock it off. You can see now, you know, the American people basically gave the mandate to George W. Bush to kill the guys what knocked down them towers. And instead, this is what they've done, is they have increased the influence of those guys and their wannabes by a zillion percent. I mean, there was a time when Al-Qaeda in Iraq was mocked for being wannabe Al-Qaeda, not real Al-Qaeda. I mean, real Al-Qaeda's over there hiding in Pakistan somewhere, or doing something, you know, over there in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But these kooks in Iraq, but now these kooks in Iraq, they're legion. There are thousands of them in Iraq and Syria and Libya and across the Middle East now. Thousands of them. They're not so much pseudo Al-Qaeda anymore, are they? Great job, Republicans and Democrats. Generals. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for listening. Glad you like it. The website is scotthorton.org, and Dave, the webmaster, is doing a great job. You might tell if you refresh, look at the front page, looks a little cleaner and nicer than before. And we got a new bookstore here, scotthorton.org/books, and there's only like four of them in there so far. Just getting it going, but you're going to have my entire recommended reading list, the ones I've read and the ones I haven't quite gotten to yet, but really want to read. So that'd be good. And I'm working on making the website more of a one-stop shopping kind of a place for my stuff, my interests, if you share them. So there you go, scotthorton.org/books. Get started buying books over there if you want. Now tonight I got a show on libertychat.com, and I have no idea who I'm going to interview. I thought that I was going to interview Tom Woods, but I guess I should have double-checked with Ian Chaffee. Coffee? I think just coffee. I think I'll just say coffee. I think he told me, just say coffee. Anyway, I thought he said Tom Woods was going to be my guest. He said, next week, Tom Woods. So I was like, okay, great. But nope, Tom Woods is starting his show on there tonight. Oh. Oops. That's too bad, because I don't have a guest lined up. And Gareth is somewhere far away to the east of here, which means it's going to be the middle of the hell of the night over there. So I can't interview him about his Iran piece, I don't think. I mean, hell, I guess I could call Gareth after the show today, see if I can get a hold of him and record one and play it tonight, if I can get it to sound good enough. But I'd rather do a live interview, you know. But anyway, something valuable will happen tonight. That's not a very good commercial, is it? LibertyChat.com.
the very best place to listen to people chat about liberty. LibertyChat.com. I'm there at 8 o'clock Eastern Time every Tuesday. 8 o'clock Eastern Time every Tuesday. And by the way, Tom Wood's show starts at 9 o'clock tomorrow. His new show on there. And Adam Kokesh has a show on there and some other people too. And it's LibertyChat.com. And go check it out. And I'll be there tonight. All right. And by the way, that bookstore, go ahead and bookmark that in your toolbar there at the top of your Mozilla, man, because I'm going to have probably about 400 or 500. Well, no, that's overdoing it. There's going to be at least 200 or 300 recommended readings there for you in that bookstore, scotthorton.org/books. So my first response is great taste in books. You got that right, and I got a lot more coming where that came from. So cool. And thanks again to Dave for doing the work that I obviously am incapable of doing myself on the website there. Okay.
Let's see. What else was I going to say? I was going to say a thing. I guess I'm just going to talk about the goddamn Al-Qaeda in Syria thing some more.
I can't get over the fact that an American went and suicide bombed himself over there in Syria. And then this other guy, this French guy that went and fought there and killed a couple of Jews at a museum in Brussels last week. I think this heralds a whole horrible, dark, dystopian future for everyone. I think there's going to be Al-Qaeda type attacks across Europe for ever now. And I think some of them will get through and get to the United States. It's just a matter of probabilities. And I hate to be a damn doomsayer on the terror war, because, of course, my role is debunking all this crap all this time. This stupid terror war, as though it was, you know, Al-Qaeda was the Soviet Union or something, when it was just a group of bin Laden and his 250 friends. And the CIA pointed lasers at them, and the Air Force dropped daisy cutters on their heads to the degree where they were only a couple of dozen escape with bin Laden back in 2001. It was literally a giant, you know, Goldstein fake enemy problem that didn't even really exist. It was only a horrible, hollow, cynical excuse for the empire. And now look what they done. They went and built up this tiny little group into a movement, into an idea. Now, there's really nothing Al-Qaeda about it. It's just angry Sunnis with guns who aren't going to take it anymore. And they exist in a hell of a lot of places. And it's been proven to them that they can fight and they can win in some circumstances. And now there are just so many of them, they're at least going to try. It's like Patrick Coburn said about Iraq. He said, now listen, just because the Shiites have Baghdad and it's probably a hopeless task for the Sunnis to try to take it back, don't tell them that, man. They don't want to hear that. They're looking at it like, hey, forget these stupid British and French borders. And my Woodrow Wilson rant. Never mind all that. We're the super-duper majority in the region. Shiite Arabs, they're the minority. They're only in southern Lebanon and Syria, in southwestern Iraq, and the very, I guess, a little of Kuwait, right? The northeastern, very small northeastern oil lands of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and that's it. I mean, there's Shiites in Persia, but they're Persians, not Arabs, right? So, but otherwise, the Arabs are all Sunnis. So the vanguard of their suicide bomber jihadi movement is looking at it like, why the hell should we back down to anybody? How did we lose Baghdad in the first place? Can't remember. Maybe it was just blame the Americans. But anyway, let's take it back, guys. So just because Mosul fell today doesn't mean what? That they're going to withdraw tomorrow? How about maybe they're going to move on from there? I just saw a couple of tweets. I don't know how credible they are, but being passed around that now they've moved into Kirkuk district in Kurdistan. Or at least, you know, could be Kurdistan. And questions already flying about whether the Kurds might switch sides here. Because after all, they are Sunnis. They've been allied with the Shiites since 2003, but why stay that way? I mean, hell, it's all politics, right? But anyway, when Patrick Coburn is warning you that this is a serious thing, I suggest that you take that seriously. I take that very seriously.
And when I say, hey, Patrick, what's up on the al-Nusra Front and the ISIS and the al-Farouk Brigade and the Northern Storm and the Islamic Front, he says, Scott, no, 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 look, they're all just the same thing over there, right? It doesn't matter. They're all at least sworn to the goals of Zawahiri, which is revolution throughout the region. They're basically they're right-wing radicals, right? They're not conservatives, but they're not leftists either. Although, actually, you know, it's funny. Loretta Napoleone talked a lot about bin Laden's economics, and actually there's a lot of kind of a Leninist fervor to a lot of what he says, too, about capital and whatever. He's the son of a billionaire. He's highly educated, of course, and was. And anyway, whatever you call it, it's not that narrow of a movement anymore. It was a group. Now it's a fairly broad-based thing. And this is a direct consequence. You know, again, I referred you earlier, and I meant it to Tom Engelhardt's new piece at TomDispatch.com, where he talks about this too. And crap, now I forgot which point in there I was going to refer to. It was a big one. Let's see. The U.S. military can't win its wars. Destabilizing force. Wars don't solve problems. U.S. style war doesn't work. No, I forget now. Anyway, thousands of these guys. And you know what? You know, I don't know, man. Right now, the FBI is entrapping some idiot kid into saying he's loyal to Al-Qaeda, who is actually, you know, would be no harm to anyone if they left him alone. Or maybe just gave him a stern warning that, hey, we're looking at you, kid, so don't you do nothing stupid. But instead, they're entrapping some idiot, and meanwhile, it could be that a real-ass terrorist who means Americans harm is ready to go. After all, they completely failed. The NSA, CIA, FBI, all of them. DIA, whoever, Army, Navy, Intelligence, whoever, for whatever series of reasons, completely failed to stop the Times Square bomber, the Detroit plane, the underpants bomber. And then, let's see. Oh, let's see. No, Zazi they did catch due to actual police work, I think. And then I'm missing some. Oh, and of course, Boston. They haven't stopped these attacks. And it's because they're too busy entrapping nitwits and nobodies. Because it used to be right that there are no real Al-Qaeda, so let's just entrap some. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. I'm saying it used to be correct there were no Al-Qaeda, so then they decided, let's just entrap some nobodies. But now, that means the next time some real-ass Al-Qaeda, some ISIS veterans, sneak into the country somehow and decide to kill some Americans, the FBI is going to be, and the rest of them will be completely AWOL, just like Boston. Just like Times Square, just like Detroit. And it isn't hard to imagine the kind of damage that a couple of serious ISIS vets could do in this country if they tried. That's our future, y'all, because of Bush and Obama.